Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. Does the Attorney General get immunity? Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 31st, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Ashcroft v. Al-Kid. The question in this case was whether a former Attorney General enjoys immunity from suit for allegedly authorizing federal prosecutors to obtain valid material witness warrants for detention of terrorism suspects whom they would otherwise lack probable cause to arrest. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held the following by a vote of 8-0. First, an objectively reasonable arrest and detention of a material witness pursuant to a validly obtained warrant cannot be challenged as unconstitutional on the basis of allegations that the arresting authority had an improper motive. Second, then Attorney General Ashcroft did not violate clearly established law. Therefore, he deserves qualified immunity. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito joined Justice Scalia's opinion. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion, which Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor joined as to Part 1. Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which Justices Breyer and Sotomayor joined. Justice Sotomayor filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which Justices Ginsburg and Breyer joined. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Richard A. Samp, who is chief counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Samp.
My name is Richard Samp. I am chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation in Washington, D.C., and I'm intending to give a few remarks with regard to the Supreme Court's decision in the case of Ashcroft v. Al-Kid. On May 31st, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed a lawsuit seeking damages from former Attorney General John Ashcroft, filed by a U.S. citizen who alleged that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated when he was arrested and held for 15 days as a material witness in ongoing criminal proceedings. Reversing a lower court decision, the Supreme Court held that dismissal was proper because Ashcroft had established a right to qualified immunity from the lawsuit. The case was billed as a test of the federal government's authority to use the federal material witness statute as a tool in its fight against international terrorism. But the decision ended up being much more important as a reaffirmation of the broad immunity that federal officials enjoy from suits for money damages. Senior officials from both the Clinton and Bush II administrations were subjected to a torrent of such suits, many of which lingered for years. One can hope that the Al-Kid decision will make lower courts far less receptive to such suits. The underlying lawsuit was filed by Abdullah Al-Kid, an American citizen who, beginning in the late 1990s, worked closely with Omar al-Hussein, the head of an Islamic charity. Al-Hussein was indicted on charges that he was raising funds for terrorist organizations, and the FBI questioned Al-Kid several times regarding his knowledge of al-Hussein's activities. Then in March 2003, the FBI learned that Al-Kid was about to fly to Saudi Arabia for an extended period of study. He was arrested while at the airport and held for 15 days as a material witness in the al-Hussein prosecution. Even after his release, Al-Kid was prohibited from leaving the country. However, Al-Kid was never called as a witness at al-Hussein's trial. As Al-Kid's case reached the Supreme Court, there was no dispute that his arrest complied with the statutory requirements set forth in the material witness statute. That statute permits the detention of a potential trial or grand jury witness if the government can demonstrate two things. First, that the person's testimony is material to a criminal proceeding, and second, it may become impractical to secure the person's presence at the criminal proceeding by use of a subpoena. Al-Kid's detention met both of those prerequisites because, first, his close association with al-Hussein meant that he was likely to have some knowledge of al-Hussein's fundraising activities. And second, al-Kid would have been beyond the subpoena power of U.S. courts during his extended period of study in Saudi Arabia. Al-Kid nonetheless alleged that his detention violated his Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. He alleged that prosecutors' stated reasons for arresting him were, quote, pretextual. That is, he alleged that the real reason for his arrest was not to secure his testimony for trial, but to investigate his possible criminal wrongdoing. They could not issue a standard warrant for his arrest because they lacked probable cause to believe that he had committed any offense. So they used the material witness statute to effect the arrest and facilitate interrogation, even though they allegedly never intended to call him as a witness at the al-Hussein trial. So where does Ashcroft fit into all of this, you may ask, since he had never even heard of al-Kid and had no involvement in the decision to arrest al-Kid? Al-Kid's ACLU lawyers argued as follows. In the wake of 9/11, Ashcroft's Justice Department publicly announced a policy of aggressively using the material witness statute as a means of incarcerating those suspected of involvement in terrorism. The ACLU alleged that it was the new DOJ policy that caused line prosecutors in Idaho to decide to detain al-Kid as a material witness, even though they never intended to use his testimony. Thus, they alleged, Ashcroft could be held personally liable for the violation of al-Kid's Fourth Amendment rights because his rights were violated as a direct result of the new DOJ policy. A major weakness in the ACLU's case was that no prior court decision had ever held that such pretextual use of the material witness statute violated the Fourth Amendment. Under the qualified immunity doctrine, federal officials are immune from a Bivens action seeking damages unless the plaintiff can establish a, quote, clearly established constitutional right of which a reasonable person should have known, end quote. It is difficult to argue that the right being asserted by al-Kid was clearly established if no court had ever articulated such a right. But the Ninth Circuit managed to make just such an argument in ruling in al-Kid's favor. It reasoned that the Fourth Amendment had put law enforcement officials on notice for more than 200 years that unreasonable searches and seizures are unconstitutional. And since the DOJ's policy was, in the Ninth Circuit's view, so obviously unreasonable, Ashcroft had adequate notice that what he was doing was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court unanimously rejected that reasoning. Justice Scalia's opinion strongly scolded the Ninth Circuit for ignoring repeated Supreme Court admonitions that the qualified immunity doctrine cannot be applied at such a high level of generality. Rather, the immunity applies unless judicial precedent is sufficiently specific to make plain that the course chosen was forbidden. In the words of Justice Scalia, immunity is intended to protect, quote, all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. In the absence of a federal court precedent directly on point, the Supreme Court unanimously agreed that the qualified immunity doctrine barred al-Kid's suit for damages. The Supreme Court went on to address the merits of al-Kid's claim that the Fourth Amendment prohibits pretextual use of the material witness statute. By a 5-3 vote, the court determined that it does not. The majority held that the court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudence has never looked to the subjective intent of law enforcement officials in carrying out searches and seizures. Rather, what matters is whether the circumstances of a case when viewed objectively, justify the action taken. In this case, the objective circumstances justified the decision to arrest Al-Kid under the material witness statute. He possessed evidence relating to a pending criminal proceeding, and his plan to leave the country for an extended period of time jeopardized prosecutors' ability to subpoena him for the trial. Under those circumstances, the majority held, the subjective motivation of prosecutors, for example, the allegation that prosecutors never really intended to call Al-Kid as a witness at trial, made no difference for Fourth Amendment purposes. Three justices, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, did not join that portion of the majority opinion. They thought the merits issue was sufficiently close that they would have ruled for Ashcroft on the qualified immunity grounds alone. So what's the bottom line? Perhaps most importantly, the court provided a ringing endorsement of the qualified immunity doctrine. One can understand the motivations of activists who routinely file Bivens actions against top federal officials. Such suits are often the only judicial path available for challenging federal policies with which one disagrees. And some lower courts have encouraged that trend by providing, at best, lukewarm support for immunity doctrine. But the court's invocation of qualified immunity in this case was so forceful that lawyers will have to think twice about filing such suits in the future, lest they expose themselves to sanctions for filing frivolous litigation. One final point worth addressing is Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion. Some ACLUers have suggested that his opinion creates a silver lining and leaves an opening for future challenges to government use of the material witness statute. Such suggestions are mere wishful thinking. First, Justice Kennedy joined Justice Scalia's 5-member majority opinion in full. So the Scalia opinion is the only one that can legitimately be looked to as expressing the views of the court. Second, nothing Kennedy said in any way undercuts the majority opinion. Kennedy merely noted that the court had not decided whether the affidavit that accompanied prosecutor's application for an arrest warrant was sufficient to justify issuance of the warrant by a neutral magistrate, because Al-Kid had conceded the point. Kennedy went on to state that the evidence might not, in fact, have been sufficient to meet the requirements of the material witness statute, because there was reason to believe that Al-Kid's testimony could have been secured without subjecting him to arrest. But at most, Kennedy's language suggests that in future cases, magistrates should be more vigilant in ensuring compliance with the statutory terms before issuing arrest warrants. Nothing in his language suggests that future litigants who, unlike Al-Kid, did not concede that the statutory prerequisites had been met, would be permitted to use a Bivens action to collaterally challenge the issuance of a warrant under the material witness statute. Line prosecutors are, of course, subject to Bivens actions if they intentionally deceive magistrates regarding the facts of a case. But nothing in Kennedy's concurring opinion suggests that they can be sued for damages based simply on a claim that they sought to invoke the material witness statute where the facts did not warrant their doing so.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.